This episode is brought to you by the Webcomic Beacon 2012 Spring Comic Book Giveaway. This spring, we're going to be giving away 4 copies of the volumes 1 and 2 of Family Bones. That is based on a true story about Ray and Faye Copeland, the serial killers. And along with that, there's going to be 1 CD pack giveaway of The Boobles, which is a mammary parody of Beatles songs. So you can go ahead and check it out at webcastbeacon.com/giveaway for more information on how to enter and a little bit more information on the things you can win.
Now broadcasting the Webcomic Beacon.
It's Sunday, February 5th, 2012, and this is episode 53 of the Webcomic Beacon Newscast with Eric Kimball from BladeBunny.com.
Greetings and salutations, Internet.
From alexsguide.net, Alex Heberling.
In before KP.
And I'm Thomas Reward from 910 Comics. That's 910cmx.com. And let's get to that news. We've got a lot of it today, and unfortunately, our top story is one that really I wish I didn't have to give, not because of the content, but because of what it actually happened. Artist Al Rio, who's done a lot of work, you know, for DC and Wildstorm. I mean, his big break came on from Wildstorm's Gen 13. He's done work for Marvel, for Dark Horse, for so many others. Committed suicide back on the 31st. Just shy of 50. It's one of those stories that you really hate seeing. It's bad because I've heard that he's a good guy. He was a terrific artist. And in fact, one of his properties, he did the art on a comic called Exposure that's going to be reprinted, redistributed over on Keenspot. I was fortunate enough to have some commissioned work done by Alan. I mean, it's absolutely beautiful work. But I had read a story where it stated that he was suffering from cancer, and you know, whether it's true or not, he apparently committed suicide because he didn't want to put his family through the lingering illness and the costs of it.
That's rough.
Yeah. It's always, I mean, cancer is bad enough, but losing someone this way is just... my sympathies and my heart and my prayers go out to Al's family, to the people who knew him. There have been a number of statements from his agent here in the States talking about it, and let's just, everybody out there who's listening to us, give our best to the family. Yeah. But then on the opposite end of the scale, we've got yet another Kickstarter story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This
is one of those ones that you just go through and say, wow.
freaking kidding.
Yeah. One of our webcomics, The Order of the Stick, which has been a long-running and good webcomic, even with the exceptionally simplistic art, has put up on Kickstarter for some money to put down for printing books and other sundry items. And at the printing of the story, back on the 31st, they had raised over $250,000.
Yeah, at this point, they are $50,000 shy of the $500,000 mark. So
right now it's at $464,000.
Yes.
Yeah, close enough for government work. I mean, $500,000.
Damn. Yeah.
I mean, I just take that, print some comics, and retire.
Yeah, like I was saying, we're allowed to hate him now. I mean, he's a, I'm blanking on his name. Rich is a great guy. He writes a great comic. He really cares about his fans. He is an example of what all webcomic creators should be. And, you know, he deserves all the best in life. $500,000, we're allowed to hate him. that's all I'm saying. we are allowed to say, yeah, you're a great guy. I still hate you.
For some reason, I can't help but think that maybe people for the donation are going to get an official order the stick.
Yeah. That would be awesome.
Straight from Rich's backyard.
Yes.
There's not enough sticks in his backyard at this point.
Didn't there used to be a tree there?
Maybe need to send twigs.
The interesting thing about the story is that there simply is a stupid amount of money floating out there on the web for people who can take advantage of it.
But emphasis on the word stupid.
Yeah, but the I want to bring up something. I mean, the show, The Colbert Report.
Oh, God.
Made up a fake super PAC, and they raised $1 million from people who just said, what the heck, I'll give a few bucks to that. And this is what happens on the web a lot. There's a lot of these impulse buys when it's made really, really easy to just throw a few dollars at something. And this is what we're seeing with the Order of the Stick. And the problem is the traditional publishers don't know how to capitalize on this. And I don't know how to capitalize on this. It's one of these things that you see this and you say, there's a ton of money out there. If only I could figure out how to get it.
It's all about, it's all about creating passion in your audience.
Yeah.
I was going to say sex and nudity, but you've already got that air.
No, Tom. I am Mr. Sex and Nudity, and
Boy, that was a mental picture I did not want.
going the pornographic route only gets you so far. I mean, you couldn't raise $500,000 with an adult comic.
I'm sorry, Eric. Yeah. I've met you in person. You and sex and nudity are a couple of things I don't want to have mixed together in my mind.
Well.
But yeah,
that's
your
problem, not mine.
That sounds like a personal problem, Tom.
All of our best to the people over at Order of the Stick. Even if you did raise a hell of a lot of money that we want a portion of, damn it. Now, over, you can hear the happy lilt over in Eric's voice because of this next story coming up. And I'm just going to sit back and I'm going to let you take over this particular story, Eric.
All right. Well, recently on her actual blog, Kate Beaton announced that she is retiring from webcomics. She is pursuing other options, and she's been given other things that she wants to work on. Basically, she became famous and was given the opportunity to have other jobs, and she jumped at it. And I mean, this is sort of a sad story because there are hundreds and hundreds of reporters out there now who have to actually do their bloody job instead of just reprinting Kate Beaton stories. I mean,
I'm clutching my pearls.
Yeah. The lost time with their families, you know, the stress. It's just a real blow to the reporters community that now
to the journalism industry.
And you see, I mean, when we were talking about it before the show, this story actually infuriates me. Because after the past year and a half, 2 years of Kate Beaton is the female face of webcomics, there's a female webcomic creator called Kate Beaton and this type of stuff. And then basically it's webcomics are a secondary thing to other mediums now, according to Kate Beaton. And you can see that we're going to be seeing this type of spin to where webcomics are put on the back burner of publishing again. And we're going to be the redheaded stepchild.
Well, no, I think this is going to we're going to see the same thing we've seen a lot of times as webcomics are going to start becoming launching boards to other careers. Mm-hmm. And this is what people are going to do. They're going to go into webcomics, they're going to get famous, and then when they're famous, they're going to jump ship for something that pays a little more. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think that it's a problem when if you want to define...
Well, to me, it's the analogy of you're taking the plain girl to the prom. And then all of a sudden at the prom, the hot cheerleader comes over and wants to dance with you, and you leave with her. Yeah. That's what we're seeing. I mean, that's basically what she's saying is, okay, webcomics, you're the plain girl. I'm leaving you behind because I've got the hot cheerleader.
I mean, yes, to an extent. But, I mean, at the same time, if you've got the hot cheerleader, why wouldn't you? I mean, just to go the other way.
Well, I mean, why not? If the hot cheerleader wants you, you never leave the dance with someone other than who you brought. I mean, it's not like she even says herself, and I quote, "The website schedule for Hark has never been something to set your watch to." Okay, then why not continue it while you're doing this other stuff? It's not like it's all consuming to her, like some of our webcomics are to us.
Tom, webcomics are not a lifetime commitment, and if you get something better, or even if you have something else that you need to do.
I've always said, I mean, if real life interferes with webcomics, I mean, real life has to take precedence, unless it's a job. And, you know, as much as I say about it, I mean, the people over at Half Pixel and Randy Mulholland and so many others, to where the comic is their job.
Right.
And in which case, you've got a responsibility to it. I think it's whether she wanted to or not, she was made a role model. She was held up as the thing for webcomics. I mean, she is the female webcomic creator. She was the go-to girl that the press was going to. And even though we made a lot of jokes about it, this is what she was.
But
in their perception.
Yeah, but that doesn't, people, you're not required to be what people say you are. And Hark was never a job for Kate. Kate was doing these for fun, and they got picked up and it got huge.
Then you've got your responsibility to your readers. And again, her schedule wasn't, you know, she wasn't doing a daily or even a weekly. But it's a situation to where, why not continue it on? I mean, the whole thing that's, I'm retiring. I'm sorry, that's just nonsense.
Would she could have gone through on infinite hiatus like other comics do? I mean,
no, I'm saying that she could have gone through.
That's kind of the what I kind of took from her post on the subject, was that Hark was just kind of going on an indefinite hiatus while she pursued, you know, the paying opportunities. And, you know, she might still post something once in a while, but it wouldn't necessarily be a even slightly irregular thing that it is now.
See, to me, it's all in the handling of it. You know, if she had gone through and said, you know what, I've really enjoyed the stuff that I've done with this, but I'm going to go to pursue other things. No, it's the whole I'm retiring thing. And that just seems obnoxious to me.
I think it's honest. I do not think that's obnoxious at all. I think that's very honest, telling people that, look, don't expect me to come back anytime soon. And I think that's honest.
You can still be honest and obnoxious at the same time. I mean, we've seen that from certain other people.
Yeah.
But let's actually talk about a different, change gears and talk about somebody else who didn't leave their webcomic job for a different job. And that is Akewood creator Chris Onstad, who, along with doing his webcomic, hint, hint, is now the resident food critic for the Portland Mercury. I wish I could get a gig like this. You know, I mean, free food and get to put people down professionally.
Yeah, I wasn't sure what to make of this, but apparently Chris Onstad is a giant foodie, so I would probably know that if I never read it. But I was never in that community.
Yeah, but for those of us who are webcomic people and foodies, I mean, he's living the dream. Living the dream, folks. I'm also saying now that over on his blog, Terry Moore, the creator of Strangers in Paradise and other comics, I think one of them is Echo, has stated that he is going to be releasing his comics digitally via Comixology, starting with Strangers in Paradise and then going on to some of the other series. I personally, I think this is a great type of story because, again, Strangers in Paradise has been around for a long time. It's been a very popular secondary comic. You know, it's not one of the big names like the superhero comics, but it's had a strong following for a long time. And seeing that he's going to the digital, expanding out the distribution, it's one of those wonderful stories to me.
Yeah, it's not particularly surprising because Strangers in Paradise, if it was created in a little later, you know, if Strangers in Paradise had started in 2000, it would have been a webcomic. I mean, the only reason it was in print is it started at a time when print was the only game. But it's a webcomic. Yeah. I mean, reading Strangers in Paradise is definitely a webcomic.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those stories that is the surprise breakout story because it didn't follow the usual tenets of comic success. It was successful in spite of everything that it was.
Yep, I agree.
Yep. Alex, you're our resident female. I mean, what's your opinion on it?
I have actually not read Strangers in Paradise. So... I know. I didn't really grow up on print comics, except for the newspaper ones. So my comic pedigree comes pretty much mostly from webcomics.
Well, then this next story comes in because we've got somebody else who's going digital, and that is Jim Davis, the creator of Garfield, is going to be releasing Garfield on the digital media as well. Random House has been publishing Ballantine trade paperback books. I mean, Garfield is over 50 different books now. I mean, 50 books and for all this time. And over the next year and a half, they're going to be publishing, republishing 4 Garfield books every month in the e-format.
Now, I didn't get a good close look at it. What format is this coming out in? Is this coming out as one of the Comixology apps, or is it just going to be a PDF?
All it says, I'm seeing in the article, is saying that it's an ebook.
Yeah, I don't think we know what formats it's coming out in yet.
Yeah. See, that's the interesting thing, because they didn't specifically mention one of these apps. And one of the things I got to say about Jim Davis is he's a very smart businessman, and he knows where the opportunity lies.
Yes.
And I'm very interested to see what he's going to pick, because, frankly, these apps are just irritating. I mean,
well, I actually see that I mean,
sort of thing.
It does have later in the story that the publisher, Ryan Doherty, the editor of the collection from Ballantine, states that it will be... we are pleased to go digital with our extensive Garfield backlist now that there are quality color devices and EPUB 3 files. So it's just going to be standard EPUB files available for Android. It'll probably be a version of it on iTunes and all that type of stuff.
But see, EPUB is DRM free, so that's better.
Yeah.
Yay!
I do have to branch off. I have to tell my Garfield story. Well, not actually my Garfield story. Way back when Jim Davis was just starting off with Garfield, and Garfield was not the cultural phenomenon that it is now, my mother was a reporter over in Indiana, and Davis is out of Muncie, Indiana, home of Ball State University. And she got an interview lined up with him. And one of the things that he had said in this interview that strikes me now today is that he wanted to keep a tight control over the merchandising for Garfield, because he didn't want to see Garfield plastered everywhere.
Just mostly everywhere.
he wanted to leave a few Garfield-free spots.
He didn't want to see Garfield stuck in windows or things like this.
What?
Yes.
What year is this?
Good Lord, this has to be early 80s.
Okay.
Late 70s, early 80s, around there.
Okay.
All
right.
So
I guess you just waited 10 years before everything exploded in Garfield's. My sisters had one of those Garfields with the suction cups on it that you stick on the car window.
Well, and I find it funny because not just because of the way that it is, but he has gone back in later years and stated that he had done work on other strips and never really saw any money for it. He created Garfield specifically to cash in on the merchandising phenomenons.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, when we talk about him being a savvy businessman, oh, yeah. So, shout out to a fellow Hoosier. Go, Jim. And glad to see he's still in Muncie. Okay, and let's go ahead, and we'll be right back with more of our top stories right after this.
The Geek Life Podcast is, get this, a discussion of all things geek. Technology, movies, television, books, comics, games, nothing is off limits. Join Mike, Paul, Richard, and Melissa at The Geek Life Podcast at thegeeklife.tv.
This program is a part of the Webcast Beacon Network and is hosted on the Rampage Network. Follow us on Twitter at Webcomic Beacon. Email us at webcomicbeacon@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail by calling 1-320-310-0922. The Webcast Beacon Network, covering and promoting creativity and the creative process since 2007. Webcomics, comic news, tropes, and web fiction at webcastbeacon.com. Now, back to our show.
And we're back. Welcome to the Webcomic Beacon Newscast. I'm your host, Thomas Rivore from 910 Comics. That's 910cmx.com. With my co-hosts, Eric Kimball from BladeBunny.com.
Hello, everyone.
And from alexisguy.net, Alex Eberling.
Well, what?
Yeah, we took our little break early because somebody had to leave us. We're not mentioning any names, but his initials are Eric Kimball.
Told you to go to the bathroom before we left.
God knows we've got enough crap going on in the news, so that's a little
you
bit more.
You guys don't stop messing around. I'm going to turn this podcast around right now.
Buckle your seatbelts, kids.
Yep. And speaking of which, next up, Jim Zupkovich's Skull Kickers printed comic has made its debut, another comic that's made its debut over on Keenspot. Keenspot is bringing over a lot of, I hate to use the phrase, reprints over to them and redistributing them in webcomic format. But this is one of them. And apparently it's been they consider it a huge success with what is, my apologies to everybody, it's one of the dumbest things I've ever seen said about webcomics. The creator, Mr. Zub, as he's been called, has an interview over on Fleen.com, and one of the things he said was, "In our first week of Keenspot, we had more unique IP visits, i.e. new readers, than all three printings of Skull Kickers number one combined." No kidding.
It's the internet.
Given that about 25% of that is robots, you know, and
50% of it are people who didn't want to pay for the printed version.
Yeah, the rule of thumb is always 5 to 1% of your audience actually cares. Yes, you have more, but that doesn't equate to anything outside of just, you know, a lot of people.
More eyes are on your product than they were before.
There are some other interesting things on here that he's got. For example, he's asked why didn't he just use the skullkickers.com website as opposed to moving over to Keen. And he comes back with this, what I consider a stock answer. Well, I mean, this is a catch-all place for all people to find out information, get comic previews, get reviews, yada, yada, yada. And if the Keen spot picks up enough steam, then it's possible he'd redirect the .com address to that.
Yeah, it's, oh boy.
The fact that he doesn't have to keep up the daily maintenance of doing the webcomic site is probably a big thing, but there's something else that's not mentioned in there.
This is something that I've been trying to look into is what's going on over on Keen, and there's a lot of sort of behind the scene things, but a lot of what it is just the simplicity of Keen for people. I mean, and you have someone who clearly doesn't know a lot about the web here from, you know, from the statements that they're making, and they're going over to Keen, and someone can take, who does know a lot about the web, can take care of it, you know, and that is an advantage to them.
Right. There's also, I mean, Keen has been a brand for a long time, and even those who are not webcomic aficionados recognize the Keen name, and certainly probably don't know most of the turmoil that's gone on in recent years. So, I mean, when Keen started marketing itself to a lot of the print companies to redistribute in webcomic format, I can see that being a huge thing for some of them, because it allows them to do that without having to take on some headaches that we've seen from Marvel and DC.
Yeah. And to be honest, there is some monetary advantage to Keen, that you do get more money from their advertising revenue. There is some amount of just when it comes down to brass tacks, it's, you actually make more money on Keen than you do doing it yourself at this point. They have streamlined their advertising process, and they can give out higher percentages than Project Wonderful, that plays particularly small.
And they aren't that as picky as about their ads as some of us are. But
that's
I hope nothing for the best for Keen, because it has been a long running brand. It is one of the brands on the forefront of webcomics, and I am glad to see that it returning to some of the things that made it as highly successful as it was, and seeing some of the print medias come over, to me, is just another victory for webcomics. We're seeing by seeing them do that.
Blurring the lines between our two factions.
Yeah, eventually the National Cartoonist Society may have to call us all cartoonists. What horror.
Clutching my pearls again.
Yeah.
But we also see something similar from Ape Entertainment. And yes, APE, that's really their name, Ape Entertainment, where they're going to be printing the Free Mars webcomic. So we're going in the other direction now. From David Powles and art by Nicholas R. And I'm sorry, I'm not even going to try to pronounce it. Well, maybe I will. Giacondino. Maybe I did it. This is a webcomic that will be starting. They're going to be publishing the collection in July, and it will be available in print and digital format and in iOS format about the same time. Now, of course, they say that the webcomic will continue in its current format. But it's, again, this is a great way of the transitioning and the blurring of the lines that we've always seen between webcomics and print comics.
Yeah, and it appears they're not just going to be a publisher, they're an ownership partner, whatever that means. So, it's an interesting little thing there.
Now we get to the story I've been looking forward to for a long time. For, good Lord, about a decade, there's been a lawsuit brought up by writer Neil Gaiman. And anybody who doesn't know that name needs to go out and look it up. I mean, he's created some of the greatest stuff, from Sandman to Coraline to American Gods to writing for the major publishing companies, both in comic and standard book format. And good heavens. But a lawsuit brought up against him, by him, against Spawn creator Todd McFarlane. Apparently what had happened is, early in the days of Spawn, way back in the 90s, somebody had told Todd McFarlane that he actually could not write. So he went around and spoke to a number of big-name writers to see if he could get them to write for him. And Gaiman accepted. And he had created a number of characters in there, such as Medieval Spawn and Evangeline in Spawn 9. And hasn't seen a dime from it. This was not work for hire. This was all verbal agreement type of stuff. And Gaiman went through and filed a lawsuit about this. And the final decision, a lot of it has been sealed. But basically what it means, what has happened is that Spawn number 9 and number 26, it was found by a jury that Gaiman was half owner of the copyright of those characters and those issues, as well as the first three issues of a spinoff featuring them. This is, to me, when we see such stories as what happened with Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster with the Superman property, or with Jack Kirby with basically everything that's Marvel that wasn't Steve Ditko. This is a huge victory for creators.
Yeah, there's now legal precedence for, you know, lawmaker or, you know, attorneys and judges to look towards whenever, you know, in the future when other such disputes will inevitably happen after collaborations like this.
Now, part of the reason I love the story is because there are a number of things in there that you will learn. For example, the statute of limitations on copyright infringement is 3 years. But that's 3 years starting at the discovery of the violation. So if somebody's been going through and printing Mickey Mouse comics on the sly for 10 years, and Disney just finds out about it now, they've got 3 years from now to file suit on that. Of course, using Disney, we know that they wouldn't even take that long. There are other issues on this, as well as there was another creator character in a similar lawsuit from Gaiman against McFarlane of a character called Cagliostro. And McFarlane's lawyers try saying that this is basically it's the chestnut of the wise drunk. So any copyright on that does not exist. And the judge had ruled that there's enough differences between the standard icon of the wise drunk and the character of Cagliostro. I mean, he's got a name, he's got a title, he's got a background, he's got a story, he's got a distinct look, that it was copyrightable. So, I mean, we're seeing a lot of laws being interpreted to where it's a benefit for the creators, whether it be of webcomics or creating for somebody else's print comics. Mm-hmm. Eric, you've had something similar happen with you. Not to lawsuits, but I mean, what's your opinion on some of this?
On this stuff, I mean, it's interesting, and it's interesting about the derivative work part of it. You know, because that frees up a lot more derivative work for use, and at the same, it's really hard to see how this would be parsed. Is it going to be the situation where people are going to start copywriting common characters, you know, common stock characters, and then start... I mean, I always think about this in terms of Disney. Sorry if I'm stumbling here. Could Disney now go through and say, well, we copyrighted all of these types of characters, and if you use them again, you're violating our copyright? And that's my concern. The other side of it is, could people make derivative works off of existing copyrights and say, well, you know, this is sufficiently different that we can use it? So,
well, it's funny you should bring that up, because when I read this article, one of the first things that came to mind to me was the lawsuit back in the 50s of National Periodical Publications versus Fawcett Publications. For those who don't know what I'm talking about, this was the famous Superman versus Captain Marvel lawsuit, where Detective Comics, which became National Periodical Publications, sued the creators of Captain Marvel, Fawcett Publications, saying that Captain Marvel was a complete derivative and ripoff of Superman. And in the initial lawsuit, Fawcett had ruled, had stated that Captain Marvel was not derived from Superman, rather he was derived from Hercules, which was also part of the original source material for Superman.
Yeah.
And the judge ruled... And it was a very interesting, because the ruling that I remembered was wrong. I had always been told that Fawcett won that. That Superman, that Captain Marvel was sufficiently different from Superman. What had happened in the initial lawsuit was that at the time, and this is a real roller coaster, folks, hold on. At that time, DC, Detective Comics, had an agreement with another company that was publishing Superman newspaper strips. And they didn't put the copyright notice on a number of the strips that were used. So it was ruled that that was a co-venture between National Periodical and this other company. so that the Superman copyright had been lost. But the judge did rule that Captain Marvel was an infringement upon the copyright of Superman, but because they lost the copyright, there was no infringement. Upon appeal, DC won. And that attended, at the time, superhero comics in the mid-50s were dying out. Fawcett decided, you know, it's not worth the fight anymore, and basically just gave up the ship.
Yeah.
This also leads, I mean, my favorite part of the whole Superman versus Captain Marvel story, because in between the time from the 50s to where Fawcett stopped publication to the early 70s when DC bought the rights to the Fawcett characters, including Captain Marvel, and started publishing them, Marvel Comics created a character by the name of Captain Mar-Vell, which became shortened to Captain Marvel, and because of a lapse in the copyright, was able to copyright that name and character, preventing DC from using the name Captain Marvel in any of the titles of their comic books.
Yep.
That's why we see Shazam rather than Captain Marvel. Copyright law, folks. It's a fun thing.
It's not for the faint of heart.
Over on thismomentforwomenincomics.tumblr.com, there is an article, This is What Women in Superhero Comics Should Be. This is one of the great things I love, is seeing some of the way that women are portrayed in comics. We see a lot of the negative stuff from Women in Refrigerators and, what was it, supergirls.com or something like that? Or
Girl Wonder.
Girl Wonder, thank you.
Boobs and butt poses. It's nice to see something positive, actually celebrating the awesome moments for women in comics.
Yeah.
Instead of just how many problems there are.
Yeah, I think this is the positive alternate. This is saying this is when people get it right.
Yes.
And it's a whole Tumblr dedicated to that.
Right. And it's not just the superhero characters, because they open up with something from Gail Simone's run on Wonder Woman, which is a very touching scene between Diana and her sister,
Donna Troy.
Thank you. But they also talk about the modern characterization of Jane Foster over in Thor, to where it's not just the meek, mild, traditional girlfriend like she was back in the 60s, but she's someone that's got a backbone on there without being, bitchy, but still has an attitude in there, has a strength to her, and has a sense of wonder, which allows the reader to pull through on that as to some of the things that she's seeing, as well as the wonder that we see from Thor in the real world through that. So it's one of those articles. We'll have a link to it over on our site, over at newscast.webcomicbeacon.com. It's one of those stories I really recommend people to go read to see how that women can still be written without falling into the traditional traps.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Thank you for the great rendition on that.
nothing else to say, Tom.
It's awesome. It makes me happy. It's uplifting instead of depressing.
Yeah. I talk about the other sites, Women in Refrigerators. You can Google that. It does show a lot of the problems with the portrayal of women in comics, especially superhero comics, and Girl Wonder, which, again, does the same thing. It is good to see the other side, that there are some people who are writing it right, even if 90% of them are Gail Simone. Over in our tech division, we've got a study. There's a website called Pinterest, P-I-N-T-E-R-S-T, that allows people to collect and share photos online with a virtual pin board. And apparently, that is driving more referral traffic than Google+, and it's nearly on par with Twitter. Now, I'm with the recent IPO of Facebook. We're seeing Facebook and Twitter getting a lot more stories in the news again. So seeing some of these other sites come up, this is, are some fascinating statistics coming up.
Yep. Now, if you have gone to Pinterest, it is it is not currently set up for webcomics at all, or comics or anything in that media. It is primarily used for sharing of wedding photos, almost. So it's an interesting thing how this will shake out. It's become a very popular site, but it's not currently a popular site for the media that we think of. It is more on the personal level of sharing photos of things that are important to you.
Absolutely. I mean,
and
I can
its name is not missing any vowels, which I think is something to be celebrated in new Web 2.0 stuff.
Hear, hear. I can see where it can be used for promotional statistics as well. I mean, putting up things like fan art or pinups from your characters or something like that, as opposed to putting up full comics, it's a great way to get a little bit of publicity and drive traffic towards your site.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that we've talked about numerous times, and probably will for a long time, is piracy. I mean, piracy bad. Except in the case of the forgotten member of Crosby, Stills, and Nash, that's Neil Young. For those of you who remember back when it was Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young, who says that piracy is a good thing. He compares it to the new radio because it's how music gets around. And he's actually got some good points on there. I mean, I can remember back when radio, I mean, there used to be a whole subset of pirate radio, illegal broadcasters from just on the other side of Mexico. This is where the famous DJ Wolfman Jack actually got his start, where they were, like I said, illegally broadcasting, and people were picking up on this and hearing things that they had never heard.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. Both sides have a valid point. Piracy is very good and positive for anything that is trying to make a name for it, for something that is new, for something that has not been seen before. So when you're going out there and trying something really revolutionary, piracy only helps you. And we've seen this over and over again, from books to comedians to anything that you're really trying to push the boundaries, piracy just helps.
Yeah. We just talked about Neil Gaiman in a videotaped interview last year. Gaiman actually stated that he used to be irate about people pirating his work until he realized he was actually selling more physical copies of his books in the countries where piracy was the highest.
Yep. It is a boost to the unknown. Now, the problem comes when you're not producing anything interesting or new. I will argue that piracy does not help the new DC 52. I will argue.
I don't think anything helps that.
But I mean, the problem comes when your product is mostly marketing. What the draw of your product is not the actual contents of the product, but the marketing behind it. Because then people pirate it, see it, don't like it, and move on. And so, yes, that is a problem. But there's a lot of evidence that show that piracy helps those who make it easy to make a new and interesting, to get a new and interesting product. The more you try to fight it, the more you try to lock down your products, all you're doing is suppressing your own sales.
It actually has a little quote in here that I found very interesting. It just goes with some of the stuff I've always said. And that's from Microsoft former CEO Bill Gates. And he said, quote, "As long as they're going to steal it, we want them to steal ours. They'll sort of get they'll get sort of addicted, and then we'll somehow figure out how to collect sometime in the next decade." So, I mean, to where he's looking at piracy, especially in Windows, as a kind of loss leader, creating a market demand to where people will be able to recoup on those losses later on.
Yep. Yeah. And, I mean, that is a great strategy when you don't have a monopoly. If you have a monopoly, then piracy is evil. And that's why you see a lot of these large media companies coming out against it, because they have monopolies in certain venues, and it undermines their monopoly. And that's what they don't like. And it's understandable. If you have a monopoly, you don't want anyone getting anything from except from you, because as a monopoly, it gives you powers to make horrible, horrible deals for people.
Well, we've actually saw that from Microsoft a decade ago. And now that the Microsoft monopoly is on the downside, it's amazing what they will do to try and do some of the stuff. And we're seeing some of the other stuff, that similar stuff. And that's what Neil Young and we've got an example from comedian Louis C.K., who put his comedy special up for free to download, just no copyright protection, just asked for $5 to download it. And he made over $1 million in less than a week.
Yep. But yet again, that's because it was something unique, it was something original, and it was coming from Louis C.K. directly. And, I mean, this is sort of the takeaway you get from the Order of Sticks story, from the Louis C.K. story, from all of these things. When it's an individual creator saying, hey, come and support me, people are going to actually pay for it because there's a personal connection. When it's a large media conglomerate saying, hey, come and watch Fast and the Furious number 75, you know, all of a sudden the emotional connection to the company is gone. And people just say, well, I'll just get it on the pirate site. So it's one of these dual-edged swords where a lot of the success we see comes directly because these are individuals making an individual and personal appeal to their audience.
And it's jump ahead in our story list a little bit. We actually have a story that I want to jump to with this, and that is talking about Beyond SOPA, Beyond Protect IP, and Beyond ACTA. There has been a quote, secret copyright agreement negotiated in Hollywood. Yeah. And that is that it's going to go down to the technical side, where there may be an individual license required for a playback buffer on every individual CPU in a computer.
Yeah, which is just
preposterous.
It's just. I mean, here's the thing that they get in trouble for over and over again. They make these rules without consulting anyone who knows anything about technical stuff, you know. And it's like, well, we want a license for every copy of this, including and a technical person says, wait, every copy. You do realize when you're shifting something from a network, it's copied like a million times, and the media companies come back, oh my God, it's copied a million times and we're not getting paid for it? We have to be paid for all of those millions of copies.
100 million licenses.
Yeah.
We've actually seen that in some of the lawsuits that the RIA has brought out, where they have some of the lawsuits they've brought out have been greater than the national product of the United States.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's just from a lack of understanding, because it's an old... If you work in a business and have grown up in a business where the model was you produce a product, you control the distribution of that product, and you make sure that every time someone listens to that product, you get paid. The internet philosophy of you know, allowing piracy to exist just doesn't make any sense to you. And you can see that, but at the same time, they're killing themselves with this, because if this goes through, the result will be two things. First of all the major services will stop carrying their products. You know, Netflix will just say, sorry, we got to close up shop. We can't do this anymore.
There's no way they can afford, you know, so many licenses on, you know, an $8 a month streaming plan.
Yeah, and we're seeing this on Netflix already. Netflix is having a real hard time, because their streaming offering is getting smaller and smaller, and the price and their fees are getting higher and higher. And this is pressure from these content producers to, you know, only show the things that we can't possibly sell already. You know, don't allow any of the prime material out there. Only show the stuff that was a bomb. But let people watch that, you know. And
Stuff that we lost money on, we don't mind losing more money on. But if we made money on it, we want to keep our money.
But the problem is, that is what is driving piracy. Piracy is driven when it is too inconvenient to get what you want. I am more than willing to pay a couple of dollars to stream a video on my computer. I am not willing to pay a couple of dollars, install some stupid proprietary method, and then only get a list of things I don't want to watch. That's, I'm not willing to do that, and I'm just going to go to the torrent site at that point. And they should look at piracy as competition, not as theft. There is a competition. They can beat the competition. They can make it more convenient than the competition to get these things, but they're not doing it. They're making it more difficult, so they're driving piracy.
I mean, it's all chicken and the egg type stuff. I mean, no matter what you want to look at it, piracy is theft. But how they deal with it, you know, if the traditional methods of dealing with it are failing, do need to change the way that they're looking at this stuff.
Well, Tom, wait a minute about theft. Let's say
piracy is not theft; it's copyright infringement.
Yeah, it's not theft because let's say there is a movie. I want to watch this movie online. The producer of this movie absolutely refuses to let me watch it online, to pay them to watch it online. They don't put it online for download anywhere. I'm not going to go and buy the CD. I'm not going to go to the theater. And let's say it's even worse. The CD isn't even on the market. Let's say the CD has not been out on the market. Let's say they're doing a Disney Vault thing. So the CD is nowhere available. I can't get the CD. So I go to a torrent and I download this movie. Is that theft?
Yes.
Why? They're not... there is no possible
The money. Here's how it is. First of all, it is their choice as the owner of the item whether to put it on the market or not.
Oh, okay.
Second of all, okay, so I mean, if they don't want to sell it, I mean, it took a lot. May not remember, it took about a decade and a half before Star Wars finally came out on videotape for us to watch.
Okay.
That was Lucasfilm's decision. And there were pirate copies. Now, tell me, what's the difference between downloading a copy of a movie and going in and stealing the DVD from the shelves?
Well, first of all, I'm not if it's not available to download and I cannot pay for it to download, I'm not depriving them of any money. Where the DVD from the shelves, I am both depriving them of a physical product that took resources to produce. And I'm depriving them of a possible sale.
There's one of your fallacies.
Not available to download. I have not deprived them of anything.
There's one of the fallacies because there has it. If there's a movie, they've already sunk millions and millions and millions of dollars to make that movie. So money has already been put into that.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not there is a physical medium of it is irrelevant. You are still stealing the product they have created.
But by that logic, I'm stealing from them if I don't go and watch a movie that I don't feel like watching.
No, because if you have not watched it, then you have not taken anything from it.
How am I taking something from it by watching it?
That's just it. You have taken the property itself, whether it be a book. I mean, if you go in, you can actually make a story of you go into a bookstore and use your camera phone to take pictures of every page.
Right.
You're not stealing the book. But you're stealing the concepts and ideas and text within the book.
By that logic, if someone buys a CD, watches it, and then gives me the CD, am I stealing the CD?
What
happened?
Because the intellectual property is still there. It was purchased for that use. Now, if you go, there's a different. I mean, this is actually where a lot of it goes, between loaning it to a friend and showing it a theater to 50,000 people.
Okay, but Tom, back up here. Let's say... let's say you and I are friends. You get a movie, you get a digital copy of a movie. You watch it on your machine. You then delete it from the machine and send a digital copy to me. Is that theft?
No, because the original copy of it is no longer with your system. This is actually one of the things. I mean, because neither of us are copyright things. I can say what I think about this, and this is actually where they've gone around. Because there have been lawsuits about ripping DVDs. You know, because the RIAA and MPAA and all the other companies don't want you to. If you want an electronic version of it, you have to buy an electronic version of it. That ripping DVDs is wrong. and it was found that you own the content. You're just simply transferring it to a different medium.
Okay.
But so that still means that they have the original content.
My argument is that, yes, the word theft has been used for copyright infringement, but I don't think it's theft. It's copyright infringement.
No, copyright infringement
is a difference.
No, copyright infringement is where you're taking the ideas and repurposing them as your own. As we said, I mean, Captain Marvel versus Superman. Captain Marvel was basically Superman repackaged. You're not doing that. You're not infringing on the copyright by repackaging it and reselling it. You are taking the original product for your own use, and that, at that point, is theft.
Data is not product.
Data is product.
Okay, we can argue this for a long time.
Let's actually go on to the next story, which goes similar about that, because that goes more into the parody law, where there have been 10 Batman webcomic parodies occasionally better than the real thing. And I think it's a great thing, because there are some of these that are actually funny. And one of the ones it starts off with is Eric's favorite. It shows Batman in Hark, a Vagrant's Sexy Batman is Unstoppable from Kate Beaton. I can't get away from it. And yeah, it does. I've seen some of the stuff. I mean, I really do enjoy the Batman humor that David Willis over with Short Pact has done. He even had one where, I mean, Batman can make anything funny and goes to prove it. But, I mean, after all the downsides of copyright we've talked about, it's nice to see that the parody law is being used to give us something utilizing a famous character like this.
Yep.
And then something similar, there's a story about fan-created Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle webcomic releasing the first chapter for free. And it's actually going to be an... I believe, over with the IDW's new series, to where they're including some of this.
This is just brilliant.
Well, it's not too brilliant, because it's IDW, and the reason why I say it's not too brilliant is they've already done something like that with the Transformers properties, where they had a series that was going on, created by fans, called Transformers Mosaic, over on DeviantArt. Mm-hmm. And it proved to be very popular. And IDW actually started printing some of these, with permission, in the backs of the Transformers comics.
Yeah. No, but, I mean, anytime you can get the fan passion and actually use it for your product, this is such a smart move. And we've seen this, even go back to Garfield minus Garfield, that comic. What did Jim Davis do? Did he send a cease and desist letter? He said, no, you're
let's
popular.
Publish it. Let's
publish it. and that is just smart business.
Well, and to me, it's also, I mean, taking, it's what I've always said about webcomics. Webcomics are a chance for somebody in podunk nowhere to put up a comic. And unlike the old days, where the only way you could do it is by getting in the print medium, which means moving to New York, which means possibly interning or following one of the other steps to get in there. This is people who would never, never have a chance, no matter how much talent they have, to create something and get it seen. And I mean, this was a webcomic that somebody made, and I'm looking at the example you've got up on the story, and it's absolutely beautiful. It's better than a lot of the stuff I've seen from the, quote, professionals printed in the past Ninja Turtle comics. So it's one of those things. I mean, I think IDW has done some great things with their marketing strategy, with the licensing strategy, and by using some of the fan created stuff. Yeah, it's genius. And on that note, speaking of genius, I want to go ahead.
Oh, thank you, Tom. Thank you.
That's what I was going to. Or, yeah.
Damn it!
Can't be too smart if you're interrupting and stepping on my lines. But I want to thank my guests, my co-hosts from alexsguide.net, Alex Heberling.
Thank you, thank you.
And to the other end of the intellectual spectrum, from BladeBunny.com, Eric Kimball.
Thanks. think.
And of course, from 910 Comics, that's 910cmx.com, I'm Thomas Trevor. And make sure to stick around because you'll be hearing Alex on the main WebBeacon podcast just later on today, or earlier today, depending upon when this stuff is released. So, on behalf of all of us, I want to say thank you for listening in, and we'll see you in the funny papers.